6 more cents a gallon when you fill up at the pump. So, what's the best use of that new revenue for the city of Jacksonville? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a nice weekend. Just ahead, a look at one argument for how to spend those gas tax dollars across Jacksonville if they are passed into law. What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, why Duval is still all abuzz about the NFL draft. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic, beginning with a good number. More than 5.6 million people in Florida have now received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. That's about 30% of the total population. Not nearly enough to reach herd immunity in this state, everyone. So go get your vaccine. Because nearly 5,000 new cases were reported over the weekend around the state and 60 new deaths. The bottom line, we are still seeing cases, deaths, and hospitalizations every single day. The sooner we can be done with this is when the majority of the population is vaccinated. So please get the shot and please keep masking up. Our other top story for this Monday, there's been a lot of discussion lately about the Jobs for Jacks transportation plan. Now, what this would do is raise the gas tax by 6 cents a gallon across the county to pay for infrastructure projects that have been long delayed and are badly needed in spots across the city. This gas tax money also, if it's approved, would overhaul the controversial downtown Skyway system. That would be an expensive project. But as local officials decide whether to pass this, some are arguing that before we spend money on the Skyway or other projects like the Emerald Trail, that's the green belt that is planned to go all around the city, that Jacksonville first needs to fulfill the promises it made to neglected neighborhoods more than 50 years ago when city and county governments consolidated. If you live in a nice middle-class neighborhood, you take for granted sidewalks, decent sewage, paved streets, lighted roads. Guess what? There are neighborhoods in this city that don't have those basic things. So, arguing that those problems need to be taken care of first, we welcome local attorney and chief of staff for former Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown, Chris Hand. He's published a new piece about this, and he's on the line now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Great to have you on the show. And here's our question to callers. How do you think the gas tax revenue should be spent? It's likely to be approved by the city council. You'll be paying 6 cents more a gallon at the pump. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So, Chris, you've been talking about this for some time now, saying that the city of Jacksonville never kept its promise to underserved neighborhoods in this city more than 50 years ago when city and county governments consolidated. Neighborhoods were promised all kinds of improvements that they never got. And I think we need to begin by explaining to listeners who maybe have never been to some of these neighborhoods around town just how bad off many folks are and how bad the infrastructure truly is. Can you explain what the conditions are in some neighborhoods to begin with? Let's start by educating people about this.
Sure, would be happy to. First, let me just say congratulations to WJCT for some of its recent successes that were reported in the Jacksonville Business Journal, and also a happy 50th birthday to National Public Radio.
Oh, thank you for that. Today, yes, yes, it's today.
We have to go back, speaking of 50 years, I think we have to go back nearly 55 years, Melissa, to the 1967 campaign to consolidate the city of Jacksonville and Duval County. As most people know, we are unique among local governments in that we don't have separate city and county governments. We have a merged, consolidated government, and that was because of a vote the Jacksonville citizens took on August 8, 1967. That created the Consolidated City of Jacksonville, which became in operation on October 1st, 1968. As I chronicled in the 50th anniversary edition of A Quiet Revolution, which is the sort of tale of Jacksonville consolidation, during that consolidation campaign in 1967, pro-consolidation advocates visited neighborhoods around Jacksonville and sort of tried to find out what some of the challenges they were facing that might be helped by a new consolidated government. And very explicit promises were made to those neighborhoods that, look, if you agree to consolidate, the new consolidated government will address some of the longstanding infrastructure needs you have, like building sidewalks, like paving and illuminating roads, like replacing septic tanks with connections to central sewer. And while there have been efforts over those 55 years, nearly 55 years since then, to address some of those challenges, there hasn't really been a sustained effort over time to keep those promises. So as a result, in some neighborhoods in Jacksonville, you still have a situation nearly 55 years after those very explicit promises were made, where those infrastructure improvements have not been implemented at this point. It has created among some concern and skepticism among consolidation. I will say, I think one of the many benefits or potential benefits of the Jobs for Jacks plan, and I think both the city and JTA deserve great credit for making the decision to invest in infrastructure, which is so important for both economic development and quality of life. One of the potential benefits is the ability to address some of these unfulfilled promises of consolidation. And to that point, for example, the city of Jacksonville's plan for spending its additional revenue is to leverage that funding to help replace septic tanks and improve drainage across the community, which very much were part of the promises that were made. What I have argued recently is that, and by the way, to JTA's credit, they have also done a number of things along those lines. For example, their plans to improve bus stops throughout Jacksonville, including more than 100 in Northwest Jacksonville, are very much in that same spirit. Mm-hmm. What I have argued over time, though, is I think what's very important is that we use this opportunity to fulfill those unfulfilled promises, not just the septic tanks, but also on the transportation side. So building sidewalks, paving roads, lighting streets. You know, a lot of neighborhoods have been waiting more than five decades for promises to be fulfilled. And this is the moment to really make significant progress on those goals.
And these are basic things that anyone living in a first world country should have access to. That's the key thing I think we need to press home in this discussion, Chris, is that there are neighborhoods in this city that don't have basic.
It is, and it's very hard, obviously, for neighborhoods to achieve economic development, for their residents to enjoy the quality of life that everyone in Jacksonville deserves without having those basic needs met, without having that infrastructure in place. You know, there are parts of Jacksonville, for example, along US 1 and Northwest Jacksonville, where it's hard to recruit businesses to some of those areas because a lot of the basic infrastructure is not in place. So this is really a function, as you say, of providing basic services, of keeping a promise that was made to these neighborhoods, because a lot of neighborhoods in Jacksonville lost political power when the county and the city merged. But the way that that was supposed to be mitigated was through a lot of these basic quality of life improvements that haven't happened over that time. So, this is a way for the consolidated city of Jacksonville and its independent authorities to help keep those promises, to provide basic services, and to enhance both economic development and quality of life.
We'll go to your calls in a moment. The number to join us, 549-2937. So, Chris, you argue that the ultimate urban circulator, that's the Skyway overhaul that would turn it into driverless cars, and the Emerald Trail, which is the greenbelt that Groundwork Jacksonville is planning to go all around the city's urban core. You argue that these are compelling initiatives, but you don't think they should have the top priority for these dollars. Why?
Well, what I indicated in the column I wrote last week, Melissa, is that both are, as you say, compelling projects that are worthy of support. And, you know, I want to just sort of praise both JTA for its vision for enhancing the current Skyway. I mean, that's bold and cutting-edge thinking that they've employed since they've been talking about the UTC for the last several years. And, you know, your news partner, the Jackson, described the Emerald Trail as one of the best ideas Jacksonville's had in years, and I completely agree with that. But I think it's important to recognize that both of those initiatives, while very worthy, they potentially have additional funding options, the ability to receive federal and state funds given some of the heightened infrastructure interest in Washington and Tallahassee. Each project can also attract non-governmental partnership. You know, for example, JTA in the past has looked for private partners to help build and operate the ultimate urban circulator, and the Emerald Trail has been successful in many ways in raising money. As the last five decades have shown, some of those neighborhoods still waiting for the promise of basic services to be fulfilled may not have that same access to capital. I think before we can truly move forward with some of these future-oriented initiatives, it's critically important that the community keep the promises that were made nearly 55 years ago to certain neighborhoods and provide those basic services, those paved streets, those sidewalks, the illuminated streets, access to drinking water. And as the city is doing with its jobs for Jack's revenue, replacing septic tanks. Very important we keep those promises and make that the top priority before we move forward with some of these other efforts.
549-2937. Let us know your thoughts on how this gas tax revenue should be spent around the city. John is on the south side. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Good morning, Miss Melissa. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I just want to, because I grew up on that side of town. What we realize here, so we proposing a 6-cent gas tax. Basically, they came up with this proposal about doing the Skyway. Now, my issue is the from State Street all the way to Dunn's Avenue, there is no economic structure in that area, which breeds the crime and the recidivism. Mm-hmm. of in and out of being in jail. So if we're going to tax for 6 cents, then we need to work to build an economic structure in the urban core. Because what's the sense in going around the urban core with a Skyway and it ain't no economics over there? It's nothing for you to do or see. You see what I'm saying? But we're mm-hmm. talking 6 cents. So if you add that up, 6 cents per dollar. You get right now gas is almost $3. So you know how much money that's going to be, Miss Melissa. And like he said, and I agree with the man, is that, yes, they made these promises 50 years ago, and systematically they have been not doing it. I remember when we voted for the better Jacksonville plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
the real history is from State Street all the way to Gulf Air is historic Springfield, okay? Once the government came, the United States government said, hey, we're going to give forgiving loans and everything to redo that side. Jacksonville came and said, hey, we're going to do the better Jacksonville plan, and this is going to help the economics and the contractors in this country, and in this city. And I know that because I was a contractor.
Okay.
And once they passed that bill, only one contractor got a job from this city.
From that part of town, you mean? Is that what you're saying?
From that part of town.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, John. And not to cut you off, I just want to get keep the conversation going. Let me get Chris to respond to your thoughts, and thanks for the call. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, thank you, John. I think John makes a really good point about just how important infrastructure is to economic development. Again, I think part of the reason the city of Jacksonville and JTA deserve great credit for their desire and plan to invest in infrastructure is it is critical for economic development and is critical for quality of life. And to John's point, if we want to build a robust and vibrant and successful economic situation throughout the city, we need to make sure that all neighborhoods have basic infrastructure. Again, from a quality of life standpoint and to help create jobs, to attract businesses, to enhance employment, infrastructure is a vital ingredient toward accomplishing those goals. So I think John is exactly right on that point. And Jobs for Jacks is a great opportunity to make some of those investments. It's just very important that we take this moment and this additional revenue that will emanate from the Jobs for Jacks plan and make sure that we have fulfilled those promises that were made 55 years ago. The plan does that. There's more we can do.
More we can do. And what about, you could hear the cynicism in his voice when he pointed out how things went with the last big city improvement plan.
Well, and that's one of those efforts. I mean, like I said earlier on, there have been efforts over time to address some of these infrastructure issues. For example, when Ed Austin was mayor, he had the River City Renaissance plan, which was a bond refinancing aimed at some of these goals. Of course, when John Delaney was mayor, there was the Better Jacksonville plan, but the challenge has been that it hasn't been sustained over time. You know, one of the people I interviewed for the 50th anniversary edition of A Quiet Revolution was someone I consider a local hero, Alton Yates, who's a former civil rights leader, was a City of Jacksonville official for many years, and who was active in that pro-consolidation campaign, trying to find out what neighborhoods needed and figure out how we address those. And he made a very good point. You know, he said that if from administration to administration and from city council to city council, if we had had some sustainability over time and just, you know, passed the baton on some of these issues, we might have made more progress over time. So part of the challenge is while there have been efforts like some of those we just talked about to address infrastructure, it hasn't always been a sustained effort over time. One of the great potential advantages of this Jobs for Jacks plan is to create some sustainability in infrastructure investment, particularly as it comes to fulfilling promises that Jacksonville made nearly 55 years ago to give every neighborhood in Jacksonville the basic services that they were promised as part of consolidation.
Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa, real quick. JTA said that they were going to have some citywide meetings regarding the proposed Skyway Express, and I haven't heard anything about them, and I've called down there a couple of times, so if you hear anything, let us know. But and this is tongue-in-cheek, I think we should use some of that 6-cent sales tax to put in our savings plan for the Jacksonville Jaguars new stadium, because that, you know, that's coming. No, this is an interesting point. That's coming up in 6 months, and it's going to be $1 billion. And now that we've taxed, you know, we've got that 12-cent tax, where are we going to go for that money?
You know, you make a good point, Mark, because certainly that is going to be an expenditure that we will be discussing very soon. So thank you for that, Mark. All right, Chris Hand, what about Mark's comments?
Well, Mark is probably forecasting this correctly, that at some point there may be a request for a new stadium. I would personally argue that before we lay one brick on that project, we have to make sure that streets that were promised to be paved are paved, and that were promised to be lighted are lighted, and the sidewalks that were promised to be built are built. Again, this is always a question of priorities.
Exactly.
And again, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now, again, but for the city and JTA making an important initiative to invest in infrastructure. But it's always about how do you structure those priorities. I think it's difficult for us as a community to move forward with all of the exciting things that can happen in the future, whether that's the UTC or the Emerald Trail, or potentially at some point a new stadium for Trevor Lawrence and others to play in down the road, until we have met and kept those commitments that Jacksonville made nearly 55 years ago. The point of consolidation was to have a single community under a single local government with the benefits of that system flowing to every neighborhood. That was the promise, and that promise has not yet become a reality. Until it does, that has to, in my opinion, that has to be the priority, not, you know, over some of these other ideas, which are important and which are worthy of support, but shouldn't be done at the expense of keeping those promises.
We're talking with attorney, former chief of staff to Mayor Alvin Brown, Chris Hand, about the gas tax proposal. How do you think the money should be spent? 6 cents more at the pump is what's on the table. Here's a tweet from our partners over at the Jackson Mag. They say the project for the Skyway doesn't really serve underserved neighborhoods. Why not reduce the amount of gas tax funds dedicated to it and free up millions for additional infrastructure projects, including the gas tax eligible portions of the Emerald Trail, they say. Lots of calls. James in Mandarin. Hello, James. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, I have a question about the gas tax. Going back to your previous point about how the city and county consolidation is supposed to help a wide berth of people, is the gas tax really a regressive tax across the whole, you know, the whole county that is only going to benefit very specific places within the county? And are we going to one of your previous caller's points, is this, are these little projects going, I mean, they're pretty big projects, but are they going to turn into basically windfalls for specific contractors? And even if we looked at trying to fulfill the old infrastructure problems, what guarantees that the jobs created and you know, the boost to the economy through some of the infrastructure development actually goes towards the improvement of the community without fat profit margins, which turn into a inefficiency to the taxpayer, but again, a windfall to the contractor? Is there something in place to mitigate any kind of shenanigans that way? Mm-hmm. And then going back to these proposals that are happening, what's stopping that from happening in those circumstances? You know,
James,
is there some other source, like a special assessment tax or something, that could be used instead of a general tax?
Thanks for that question, James. Chris.
Well, there's sort of a common thread in something that James said and something that the Jackson noted in its tweet to the show this morning, which is, I think there are ways for some of these other projects to be even more connected to some underserved neighborhoods in Jacksonville. For example, the folks at the Jackson have been very consistent on saying that one way to look at the UTC project would be to expand its scope. Right now, under the current plan, I don't believe JTA has destinations in neighborhoods like Durkeyville and Eastside and Newtown. Maybe even places like Brentwood and Phoenix that are relatively close to downtown, but are neighborhoods that I think would benefit from enhanced transportation solutions. So to the Jackson's point and James's point, it's very important to look at this and how do we create the most impact for neighborhoods.
Go ahead, Chris. We're almost out of time. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I just wanted to get a few comments on the air from listeners, a few emails. Here's one. We need to set a priority on things like eliminating septic tanks, installing street lighting, and repairing streets. That makes sense. Here's another email. Long overdue. Look at the refurbishment of Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. Amazing recovery in a few short years. Here's another email from a listener. Scott says, I'm in full support of JTA's plan over the Skyway. People don't like it because it doesn't go anywhere, but this will allow autonomous vehicles to go to the stadium, Brooklyn, and more. And one more tweet for you, Chris. The federal government also plans to raise the federal gas tax, so which taxes will pay for which projects? That's a tweet from Ann.
Well, I think a lot of those tweets and comments, Melissa, go back to a central point, which is that it's very important that the city of Jacksonville and JTA have made this effort to invest in infrastructure. So they deserve a lot of credit for doing that. And parts of this plan, such as the city's priority on replacing septic tanks and some of what JTA is doing in terms of bus stops, and frankly, what JTA has done in recent years with access to health care and food security, all go into the general category of fulfilling promises of consolidation. It's important that we take that even one step further, though, and that we look not just for these funding sources, but as some of your listeners have alluded to this morning, that we leverage other funding sources as well. The federal government, as we know, is now the Biden administration and Congress making a big infrastructure push. This is also a priority in Tallahassee through the state legislature. With that level of interest in infrastructure at every level of government, this is a unique and opportunity here in Jacksonville to invest in those promises that were made nearly 55 years ago, help to fulfill those to ensure quality of life and economic development and basic services, and also help make sure that Jacksonville is ahead of the curve from an infrastructure standpoint throughout the community. So we're at a key moment here. Jobs for Jacks comes at an opportune time. And if we do this correctly, there could be decades of benefit for our community.
Well, we'll continue to follow it. Pick up Chris's book, A Quiet Revolution. You can also follow him on Twitter and see what he's been writing about this. Attorney Chris Hand, who knows so much about the history of this city, always good to get your insights. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later in the hour, why Duval is still all abuzz about the NFL draft. But up next.
Our target audience is always the families with limited resources.
It is a free Florida program that you may not have heard of, but it's helping families across the state eat better. We'll explain next. Over the last year of this pandemic and the recession that came along with it, families have needed plenty of extra resources. One of them we want to tell you about right now is a free family nutrition program now serving most Florida counties. I spoke about it with Denise Cox. She's a nutrition educator with University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Take a listen. Hi, Denise. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, let's begin by explaining what is the Family Nutrition Program in Duval and also Nassau counties.
Yeah, Melissa, the Family Nutrition Program is under the direction of the University of Florida, IFAS, which is Institute of Food and Science, Extension Office. And we are the Family Nutrition Program. We call it FNP. We provide free nutritional information to SNAP-eligible people in Florida. We've been doing it since 1966, and we provide the free resources to local organizations to support and promote healthy eating and physical activity in our community. Right now, believe it or not, we're in 40 counties.
40 counties?
40 counties here in the state of Florida.
Oh, wow. So you're really moving around, making an impact around the state. Who's the target audience for this program?
Right now, our target audience is always the families with limited resources. And that means these are people on budgets. Most everybody's on a budget, but we're talking about SNAP-eligible families. And what we can do is teach them how to eat healthier and stay on a budget. And we want to promote physical exercise. A lot of my audience, believe it or not, are caregivers later in life, and they're taking care of grandchildren. They're on these limited budgets. So here they are having extra family members to provide healthy meals for. So what we do is we can go in, give these classes free of charge, science-based, and we provide the knowledge and the support. It's easy to walk and say, you need to start exercising. But if we're there on a weekly basis or biweekly basis, we can say, hey, how are you doing? Is there anything we can help you with? And answer questions like that. Melissa, it's kind of scary. Most of our, the national average for obesity is 30%. Here in Florida, it's 28%. One in every five of our children are obese. One in three adults. And we all know this leads to a lot of health problems. Not only are you looking at type 2 diabetes, but you're looking at other chronic diseases that are related to weight. So we want to say, guys, you know, you may be on this limited income, but we can show you how to get stay on a budget, how to read your circulars, how to look at unit pricing, how to use the underused beans of our protein food group to make healthy meals. And we do this by offering numerous programs that are catering to the audience that we see.
And in this pandemic, I would think this is even more impactful than ever. How are you seeing that?
Well, you know, our food banks are just slammed. You'll see cars around the corner. Most of them aren't going in person right now. But you'll see the cars lined up, and there's so much need out there. All of the churches have said they are getting more and more of an increase. So it's I think it's even more important than ever. Last year, we reached 39,000 people in the state of Florida. And we partner with our schools, our child cares. We've got community gardens in. We have over 1,000 partner sites throughout the state, and that means that these are people that come to us or we go to them, and we provide this education. I just finished at ARC Nassau, which is for adults with intellectual disabilities. And I went in there and taught an Eat Healthy, Be Active class curriculum. Then we put a community garden in. We also work with Barnabas in Nassau County, where I'm at. And it's just been very, very successful. I can't say enough about how we have a very huge talent pool of nutrition educators that can go out and work with these people on these budgets, on limited budgets like this.
And I'm sure there'd be more people and groups that want to take advantage of this. It's free, after all. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, Melissa, the other thing I do want to say first is that this is science-based. We do not promote any type of a certain diet or a certain product. We are science-based, supported by the University of Florida. And everything that your nutrition educators will do if they go out on site to you or virtual is that you can be guaranteed that everything is all been, vetted or whatever. It's all approved and supervised. So we do not promote any individual product or anything like that. What makes us different is that, and if they want to get us, is that we are free, just like you said. If they want to get a hold of us, they can contact here in the Duval County office. They can contact the UF IFAS Extension office. It's here on McDuff. And in Nassau County, where I work, the Extension office is on US Highway 1. You can also Google us, UF IFAS Extension Family Nutrition Program. We have a website that gives a list of all the programs that we can offer, too, along with it.
Thanks so much, Denise. Denise Cox, she's a nutrition educator for UF's Family Nutrition Program, operating in dozens of Florida counties now. Thanks, Denise, for spreading the word.
Oh, no problem, Melissa. Thank you for having us on.
Well, Atlantic Beach is a lot more colorful these days, thanks to a really vibrant new mural project. Some of the artwork you can go see is the product of nationally renowned artists. Atlantic Beach Mayor Ellen Glasser is on the line now with more about this. Hey, Mayor Glasser, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to talk to you. Now, this all was instigated by the local organization Art Republic and their Enlightened Art Festival that they held in Atlantic Beach in April, featuring 20 mural artists along Mayport Road. But the word spread about this, and it attracted some talent from Miami and other parts around the area. And it's really remarkable what was completed. Can you describe what people can come out and see?
Well, it has been a really exciting project that the City of Atlantic Beach partnered with Art Republic. And I learned so much about community and the power of art, public art, and just what you can do with a brush and a can of spray paint. So once these fabulous artists started to do their thing, people just wanted to be a part of it, and it just exploded with interest and more artists wanting to have their works on the walls. It's quite a cool thing. I mean, we call it like a street art gallery on Mayport Road.
And you've gotten local artists featured like Philip Bennett Walker of Atlantic Beach, Mubarak Abdullah III of Jacksonville Beach, but nationally recognized muralists came to work on these walls. And so this is getting national attention, by the way, putting Atlantic Beach on the map, in a sense, in the art world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in Atlantic Beach, we always knew we were an artsy community. You know, we're pretty eclectic, it's just a great place to live. But we've made a priority of revitalizing Mayport Road, and the area that we targeted was kind of a dilapidated part of town. And so as a result of this effort, people are actually talking about driving to Mayport Road to see this. So, we're very excited about these really well-renowned artists coming to our city. I don't know that they had worked together in this kind of a community on a project like this before. I mean, it just had such a synergy and positive vibe to it. And I think the local artists, they wanted to be a part of it. And actually, there was a call to artists. So when we heard from people locally that wanted to participate, we gave them a wall, and they're up there too. So it wasn't just about having this quality artwork from, some of these other places like Wynwood down in South Florida, but it was about capturing what's important in our community. That was really important in terms of the themes that we identified from the city. I want to make sure you know this is a partnership between the city and Art Republic and some private sponsors. We did a 50% match with the city, so this was definitely a buy-in from a lot of people, and we're so grateful.
People need to go out to Mayport Road and see this, and while they're out there, they should stop at Voussoir Restaurant and Lounge at 51 Robert Street. It's adjacent to the Mural Park. Forbes.com recently reported on all of this, pointing out that the Voussoir has been a pillar of Atlantic Beach's Black community for decades. It opened before the Civil Rights Act passed. The city was still segregated when the Voussoir opened its doors. You can really enjoy some history if you go in there and then check out the Mural Park, which is becoming a focal point. And also, when the festival was happening, Mayor Glasser, there was a digital light and sound projection as part of the festival. Lots of energy that Art Republic has brought out to this beach's community. And this is just an extension of what we've been seeing in the urban core, by the way, for some time, large-scale murals and public art projects. As a public official, how do you see public art as a tool of economic development and urban planning and city improvement?
Well, I think there's a lot of science behind the power of public art in terms of beautification and revitalization. So I'm glad you mentioned the Voussoir because, part of this is also education and speaking to youth in our community and building unity. And talking about the history of that community, Black Pine in Atlantic Beach, and the Voussoir has really done a lot to build unity in the community. So the Voussoir and Mr. Ernest Davis, there's a fabulous mural on one of the walls of the Voussoir that is definitely worth a trip out to visit. And I just want to mention that also I want to thank Jessica Santiago, and I want to thank our city manager, Shane Corbin. This was not an easy thing to make happen, but together we worked on it, and then we just kind of jumped off the cliff together and just knew that it would work, and it has. The digital art display at One Ocean was rather remarkable. It was a piece of the Enlightened Festival, and it was only up on the two walls of One Ocean for about 5 days. But it was a remarkable work. I think our city is going to put some of this information up on our website so people can check it out and just see what the message was behind the artwork and just how powerful it is in terms of bringing people together, living in the now, and just actually feeling good about being out, in our community and, after a really hard year. So
yeah.
I just, it's just moved me so much. I can't tell you. I mean, I was at a dinner last night, and the topic switched to public art, and I could have talked about it all night. So it's changed me as a person, too.
Well, people need to go check out this mural project in Atlantic Beach. And by the way, before we let you go, the Karate Kid Netflix program, Cobra Kai, it's the sequel to the original Karate Kid series. Were they filming in Atlantic Beach last week? That's what we're hearing.
Well, I'm going to say the city did not make any public statements about any productions that were going on in Atlantic Beach, but we were very excited about one, and we hope they'll come back. And it's a very popular series. It involves the martial arts, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Why did they choose Atlantic Beach? Do we know how that shook out?
Well, for anybody that knows Atlantic Beach, you know we have some really beautiful homes along the oceanfront, and you know there's some just fabulous opportunities for any kind of production to film in the area, and plus it's just a great place to be in Florida at this time. It's getting safer, and I don't know why anybody wouldn't choose Atlantic Beach.
Well, there you go. Spoken like a true mayor. She's Mayor Ellen Glasser of Atlantic Beach. Check out the mural project along Mayport Road. Stop at the Voussoir, a real piece of history there. And you might see a film crew while you're out there. Who knows? Mayor Glasser, always good to have you.
Can I give one quick shout out to all of the artists? Who came. It was just a phenomenal experience of community, and we thank them for bringing their talents to our city.
Absolutely. It's exciting. These are nationally renowned artists coming to participate, so go check out this mural project along the Mayport Road corridor. Mayor Ellen Glasser, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A quick break, and when we come back, why Duval is still all abuzz about the NFL draft. That's in a moment. Don't go away.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at 904-281-5757. Congaree & Penn Landscape Trees, Jacksonville's family-owned large tree installation, relocation, and comprehensive landscape installer. More info and appointments available at congareetrees.com or 527-1945.
I'm Tanya Mosley. The race is on to create an effective COVID-19 vaccine for the youngest of us.
Well, we're still in our early stages, but I expect that we're going to ramp up pretty rapidly. And yeah, the kids are doing very well.
A Stanford doctor gives the latest on the COVID vaccine trials for children ages 6 months to 12. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2. on WJCT News 89.9. On the next Fresh Air, writer Nicole Lynn Lewis, whose new memoir tells the story of her teen pregnancy and her determination to get to college, despite the many challenges she faced, including an abusive boyfriend and being temporarily homeless. She graduated and eventually founded the nonprofit Generation Hope to help other teen mothers who get to college. Her memoir is Pregnant Girl. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
As NPR turns 50, you've been telling us what you don't like and what you do. Nicola caught us from Los Angeles.
My memories as a child are of being in the back seat of my dad's car and listening to car talk. NPR means everything to me.
We'll mark a public radio milestone and hear what you want from NPR in the next 50 years. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville is still buzzing with excitement over last week's NFL draft. Our director, Josh Torres, is a big football fan. He's here now to tell us why he thinks this afterglow is still hanging around. Hey, Josh.
Hello, Melissa, and hello to everybody. I know usually I'm behind the microphone.
That's right.
But today, I'm proud to be here to talk all things NFL with you guys. And, of course, number one overall was Trevor Lawrence. This was a pick that was made. Urban Meyer said it himself. It was made back in February. There was no way this was not going to be Trevor. He's happy to be here. He came in Friday. He already is acquainting himself with everybody within the organization. He met with the staff, had his first press conference, and he seems very happy, and the fans are happy too. The Jaguars are reporting already season ticket sales are going through the roof. They said they haven't seen anything like this since 2018. The year that they almost went to the Super Bowl. And they even said that most of the people who are buying, about 50%, are people who have never even bought a ticket to a Jags game or had any kind of communication with the Jaguars. So you can see a lot of people are very, very excited to see Trevor. Then we go down to number 25 in the first round, and they kind of surprised everybody taking Travis Etienne, who was Trevor's teammate at Clemson. And you know, a lot of people looked at this and were kind of scratched their heads, but I like the pick. A lot of other fans are really, really enjoying the pick because it's good for Trevor to have his teammates, somebody who knows him, who can kind of let everybody within the organization know, hey, this is what he likes to do in this play. This is what he likes to do here. And he's a good running back, very fast, good pass catcher. And actually, let's take a little listen to what Trevor had to say about his teammate joining him in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I was honestly not expecting it at all. And then we had been celebrating and hanging out and taking pictures and doing everything. So we weren't even really watching the draft. And then we knew we were picking at 25, so started watching around 20. I had no idea who we were going to take. And then I got a text right before it went on TV, we're picking Travis. So I was like, I didn't even know we were going to take a running back. It was awesome. So like I said, it just makes it special. I got someone to come with me from Clemson, and it's just awesome.
So, yeah, you can see right there the number one overall pick's already happy to have a familiar face in the room.
Sure. And, you know, going beyond even the excitement over Lawrence and what he can do for the team, he just married his girlfriend, Marissa Mowry, a few weeks ago. So we have this new young, attractive celebrity couple in town that I think there's a lot of interest in, too.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's been happy to see the two of them. Obviously, I'm sure you heard about the big donation that Jags fans all pulled together to get them a few items off of their gift list. And then Trevor turned around, paid it right back forward. And he's going to make a big donation to some local charities.
That's great to see. And let's hope for a great season. Okay. So obviously Trevor Lawrence got all of the glory here with his being the first round pick. But Josh, you have some thoughts about the rest of the picks.
Yeah, we go down to the second round. They picked Tyson Campbell out of Georgia, cornerback. This one was kind of surprising because last year in the first round, they picked CJ Henderson. But, you know, during the season, he was a little shaky. Can be, you know, a bad rookie year. Then he got hurt. He was out for about 8 games. So this is kind of starting to raise some questions about whether or not the Jaguars are going to trust him going forward. They also signed Shaquille Griffin out of Seattle as a free agent. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how that happens. Then they also picked Walker Little. This definitely was a little surprising because he hasn't played in 2 years. He played at Stanford. He was injured in 2019, and then he ended up sitting out all of 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and the uncertainty about the college season as a whole. But before he sat out, he was actually rated as one of the highest offensive tackles and was projected to go a lot higher if he hadn't sat out. So this was definitely a good pickup. Then we go down to the third round. They picked Andre Sisco out of Syracuse. Really good guy. Definitely has good vision on the field. It can be a ball hawk. Does need a little work on tackling. Had some trouble there. And then we go down to the fourth round, and we got Jay Tufele out of USC. This guy also sat out in 2020, but before he sat out, he was actually projected as a second rounder. So the Jaguars are essentially getting a second round talent for fourth round price, which definitely helps out with the spending cap there. And then they also picked Jordan Smith, the defensive end out of UAB. Good closing speed on him. He's got long arms, so that really can throw an offensive tackle off. And then we go down to the fifth round. They got Luke Farrell, a tight end of Ohio State. They finally got a tight end. Not a great pass catcher, but definitely can do some blocking on the offensive line. Then also we got, and he's a tight end. Now we also have news that Tim Tebow, the former quarterback out of Florida, who obviously played under Urban Meyer, he worked out for the Jaguars to possibly be a tight end. So it's definitely going to be some news we're going to be looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, we'll have to follow that.
And then finally in the sixth round, we picked Jalen Camp, a wide receiver out of Georgia Tech. Good frame, good speed. He averaged 16.8 yards per catch out of there. So the Jaguars fan base is definitely excited about this draft, and it definitely looks like it was definitely a good draft for them.
And a few local players got drafted. Mac Jones out of Bowles to the Patriots. Sean Wade from Trinity Christian in the fifth round to the Ravens. So congrats to those guys. And congrats to Josh Torres with his on-air sports debut here on this show. And you'll be hearing more from him. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that is our show. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. If you missed any part of the show, it'll be up later today wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also listen to our content through the WJCT app. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.